I got some water, yes.
Hi, everybody. My name's Alan, and I am an alcoholic. And it's been through the grace of God, the actions of this program, good sponsorship. I've been sober since August 6, 1989, and I'm really grateful for that tonight. If you're math challenged, that's 25 years and some change. And I will tell you that that's a whole lot longer than I ever planned to be in AA. I thought coming in and getting my card stamped and leaving once was all I was going to need. I will tell you today that it's my great honor and privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am delighted anytime anybody gives me the opportunity to tell my story. Okay, I'm going to apologize up front because I cry. Because this is a powerful deal to me. And what you read at the beginning of the meeting, you know, is different than a lot of places that I've heard speaker meetings, you know, and they tell their whole story and they get done, and I never hear God mentioned once. And I'm delighted that you have a focus here that says this is what we're talking about. It's in the book, even, if you'd like to read that. Anyway, let me get my manners out of the way. Billy, thank you so much. Thank you so much for the opportunity to do this. I have a home group. It's a Common Solution group in Charlottesville. It's the best group in town. If you don't believe it, we'll fight afterwards. Because I'm still not well. I have a sponsor. His name's Nob. He lives in Bellevue, Nebraska. He has a sponsor, and he has a sponsor. And I come from a lineage where I wear a tie tonight because I was told very simply, this is what we do. He never told me, you must wear a tie. He said, if you want to be one of us, then you'll do what we do. And this is what we do. And I wear the tie tonight for a number of reasons. One, because he tells me to. Two, I do it out of respect for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that gave me much more than I ever dreamed. I've heard a lot of people tell their story, and what they say is Alcoholics Anonymous saved their life. And that's not my story tonight. I didn't have much worth saving when I got here. And what happened to me is Alcoholics Anonymous rebuilt me and gave me something new and really wonderful. And I'm going to try to tell you about that tonight. I don't have enough time to tell you the story. I just don't. It has been, Bill described it, that we had been rocketed into a fourth dimension. And I couldn't even begin to tell you a little bit about what that's been like, you know, since I've been sober. But, you know, I need to tell you about how I got here and how that happened. I grew up in a home with wonderful parents. I didn't know that at the time when I was growing up. I thought that it was incredibly dysfunctional. We didn't call it that. We called it Southern Baptist. But I had wonderful parents. I never saw anyone drink in my family. None of their friends drank. My parents were both mail carriers in East Detroit, Michigan, and the Christmas present of choice was a bottle. And the deal was they just stacked up all these bottles in December into the bottom of the closet, and then they spent the year giving them away to drinking friends. Never saw them drink, had no idea. You know, none of my relatives drank, and they were just good people. Now, that's a lot different than the story that I told when I came to AA. A psychologist handed me a sheet of paper one time, part of my story, with open-ended sentences. Just complete these. Love is. And I thought it was a trick test. Not worth my time. You know, my mother damaged me psychologically as a child. My father didn't love me enough. You know, and I just came with a lot of baggage about how I felt, you know, I grew up in this terrible home, and I learned something different here, you know, as the lights came on. So I grew up in this home, and my parents walked the walk. They went back and forth and did this church deal and instilled some morals in me, and I had a pretty good upbringing. They were middle-class folks. When I was 12 years old, let me back up just a touch. I wet the bed until I was 9 years old. And this is the way that my head works, okay? My parents were from northern Alabama. And every year they would pack us up in the car. My sister was 10 years older than me. And we would drive down to Alabama and we would spend a couple of weeks with both of their families, and then we would drive back to Michigan. It was about the only time of year that I saw them. And the way that we dealt with Alan's little problem is we just had a rubber sheet, and they would fold that and put that on top of the suitcases, and when we walked into the big family reunion with everybody sitting around, here's Alan's rubber sheet, and everyone went, oh, look, he still pees the bed. And the way that my head works, I process that to my mother doesn't love me. Because if she did, she would never humiliate me like this. When I was 10 years old, my parents sent me to Alabama for the summer, and there was a much longer story there, but they sent me to go spend the summer with my grandmother. And she got me up every hour, put me in the bed with her, got me up every hour, took me to the bathroom, back and forth, and in a few weeks, I didn't wet the bed anymore. And I processed the same thing. I said, my grandmother loves me, my mother doesn't. And when I was 12, my dad said, I want to move back to Alabama. Most of the family didn't want to go. I thought the idea that I could have a gun and a fishing rod and I could use both of them in my backyard, I went, this is a good deal. Let's go. And we will be near Ma. And my life will be complete. It'll all be great. And right after we got there, Ma died. And my reaction to that was profound and immediate. I just said, I don't want to live in a world without her. It isn't worth living. And I did the only thing that I knew how to do at the time. I went and I got on my knees and I prayed and I said, God, I don't want to live in a world without her. And I cannot live with this pain. So you need to take care of it. And I got up off my knees and this incredible peace washed over me. And I went, wow, this deal works. And I wandered around through the process of the funeral and going through it, and I cried on cue when I needed to. But, you know, the point was that I was fine, and I knew that God had this, you know, that I had something in my life that was working. I rolled along for a few years, and I had what was called in the Southern Baptist church a call to preach. And I was sitting in a pew, and I was a teenager, and I was busy trying to figure out whether I wanted to run with the Southern Baptist kids or I wanted to run with the other kids. And all of you know who the other kids were. The other kids were drinking. And that was tough because we were in a dry county. And so you had to go to some effort to go drink. Anybody know what a dry county is? I'm going back and forth, and suddenly I get this overpowering deal of, hey, I really want you to go be a preacher. And I went, preacher Budweiser. I don't think so. And I left the church and made a real conscious decision, and I'm not going back again. I want to go hang out with these other folks. I don't recall what my first drink was like with any clarity. I can tell you about my first drunk. I drank something called Apple Malt Duck. They didn't make it for very long. Oh, I love this crowd. Oh, you are my people. You know, I've told my story a bunch of places, and there's just an awful lot of people that are like, huh? You get south a little bit, and people start going, ew. but my friends told me, if you'll drink it through a straw and you'll drink it fast, it'll be good. And they were kind of right. It was not good until I had the fourth one, and I drank it really fast through that straw, and then everything was wonderful. Everything was absolutely wonderful for a few hours. And then the rest of that night went downhill, and it got very bad and very ugly, and I got very, very sick, and I stayed that way. And I made a conscious decision that I would do that again every chance that I had for the rest of my life. Nothing ever made me feel that good. And in some inventory work, what I can tell you is, I found a temporary solution to a spiritual problem. You know, what I found was a way to be okay. To have some kind of sense of peace and comfort. I love the line in the book when it says, you know, that alcoholics drink for that sense of ease and comfort. And that's exactly why I drank. I graduated high school. I got married to my high school sweetheart, which is kind of a misnomer. But I married this girl that wasn't my first choice, but it was what was in front of me. And I went, okay, this will work. And she got pregnant very quickly, and we had a little daughter. And I started raising them the way that I knew how in Alabama, which I stayed drunk. I stayed on unemployment, and I smoked outside issues. And And I liked it a lot. And, you're not working. You're staying drunk most of the time. Life is really, really good. And I looked up one day and I looked around and I thought, I will do this forever and it will never get any different. I already have people looking at me going, God, what a disappointment you are. What's it going to be like down the road? I need to run away. So I went down to a recruiter's office, and the recession was in full swing in the early 80s, and said, put me in the Air Force. And they said, sure, we can do that. And they turned me into a Air Force meteorologist, which is an incredible job for an alcoholic. You get to lie to people, and they pay you regardless of what you tell them. Way back in the day, we used crayons. We got to color. We were a little bit like drunken kindergarten teachers. But it was, I came away with some useful skills. One, I can tell you what kind of clouds they are outside. And two, I can point at a blue screen and talk at the same time. When I was in school, we had a pretty challenging school. I drank every weekend because it was the time that I could drink and I could get away with it. And I immediately had people questioning what my drinking was like. And when I began just telling people the truth, it was like, how did you drink? I drank until I got drunk. Drunk? Until you got a little buzz? No, drunk. Like, I can barely tell you my name, drunk. Until everything in the room goes away. Until your silly rules and your uniform and your creases and your school and your tests, until it all goes away. It gets quiet, drunk, like that. And they went, ooh, that's a problem. Not for me. And they shooed me off to a little alcoholism treatment, one day seminar here. This is what booze does. And I went, well, sure it does. And this is a good idea. And, off I ran. My wife and my daughter were still in Alabama. I was going to school in Illinois, and I was really concerned that my best friend, I'd asked him to take care of her while I was gone. And I was worried that his idea of taking care of her and my idea of taking care of her were a little different. So this is how my alcoholism works. So I'm very concerned about her and about our marriage and about whether or not this is going to last. So I go down to the local tattoo shop that has a big sign on the door that says, will not tattoo you if you've been drinking. So I go down there sober, and I say, I want a big heart on my arm with flowers around it and her name through the middle of it. This will show her how much I love her. If that logic makes sense to you, you should be in an AA meeting. Off I get my little tattoo. I go back to the barracks. I sit down. I look at this thing, and this is a very bad idea. And there's a way for me to fix that. See, I just drink. I just drink until, a little while later, I go, look at the colors in that. This is really nice. And I drink a little more, and it's like, she is really going to love me better now. I drink a little more, and it's like, everything is going to be okay. Fast forward a little while, I came to find out that my best friend did have a different idea. And I just said, it'll be okay, and I just drank some more. And that was a pattern for me over and over and over again in my history. I can tell you a lot of my story, what it boils down to, one piece at a time. Alcohol let me live with things that weren't tolerable. That whatever kind of pain that I had going on in my life, just give me enough booze and it'd go away. And I could get up the next day and it would be okay. When people said, alcohol, that's like a form of escape. I went, yeah. What's wrong with that? If you lived with her, And infidelity started becoming just a part of your normal life, then you would drink too. That's the way that you deal with this. We moved to California, and my alcoholism was in full swing. The Air Force made it okay for me to drink. They had their own little clubs. They were segregated. They said, you just go drink here. This is the Airman's Club and the NCO Club and the Officer Club. Pick where you need to go and then just go there and drink. We'll subsidize your drinking. It'll be cheap. We'll give you a credit card if you like. We'll hook you right up. And off I ran. When I was in California, I got bankrupt. I went financially bankrupt. I filed bankruptcy. I got divorced. I got remarried. That was the first year that I was there. And then it got bad. And that was the place that people started looking at me, and they started using the word alcoholic. They said, you don't want to have anything to do with him. He's alcoholic. I started calling that woman plaintiff, and I ended up with this very awkward tattoo, and I met wife number two, and, you know, made this really conscious decision that, you know, this is a very bad idea. So I go down to a tattoo shop. I say, you need to fix this for me. He takes one look at it and says, okay. He puts some cute little flowers over her name. So now I have a heart with flowers around the outside and flowers over where a name used to be that looks like you covered up a name with flowers. It was as macho as, you know, skull and crossbones kind of. It was great. Sober. Sitting there with her and looking at it and going, I will never, ever, ever do anything like this again. This is crazy. And the pain and the guilt and the remorse of living that kind of life, you know, made that next drink perfect. Just perfect. I've heard a lot of people tell a story in AA that alcohol quit working for them, and that's not my story. My story is that alcohol worked from the first time that I drank it until the last time. If I drank enough, then the problems went away. And that was my goal. I began to have consequences that came along with that. I started having what I call brownouts, you know, where I just missed little pieces of the evening. You know, the whole thing didn't go away. I just missed talking to Bill. You know, my wife would say, you remember talking to Bill. You were in the corner. You were arguing. It looked like you were going to get in a fight. And I just thought Bill wasn't important. That was why I didn't remember him. And I started missing chunks. And bad things started happening. I never found out that I had donated money to the Sisters of the Poor while I was blacked out. It was always bad. You know, I just, one by one, what happened in my drinking history is I began to sell my morals one at a time for the privilege of drinking. And all the things that I said that I would never do, all the things that I had grown up with that weren't acceptable in my life or anyone's life that I knew, started becoming normal, and I just drank them away. Fast forward a couple of years, I've got number two with me, and she's in northern Japan. I'm walking down a back alley in Okinawa, going, boy, I'm really worried about the best friend that I have up there. I've asked him to take care of my wife, and I'm a little concerned about how he might be doing that. I go to a little tattoo shop that has a sign on the door that says, we will not tattoo you if you've been drinking. So I go in there stone cold sober and say, we'll make it better this time. Put I love Tracy across my chest in great big script letters. Hype. And off he goes. And into, you know, a little piece of saran wrap. And he should have had a sign that said hepatitis sold here. It was the nastiest place I've ever been in that had a needle. And I get back to the barracks, and I look at this thing, and I go, there wasn't enough booze in the refrigerator. There wasn't enough booze to make it go away. And I started having problems living the kind of life that I was living and being able to survive. I think the only reason that my alcoholism didn't hit, the train didn't wreck any quicker than it was, is in whether we worked rotating shifts. So my typical work assignment was 3-day shifts. I had 2 days off, 3 afternoon shifts, 2 days off, 3 night shifts, 2 days off, and then back again. My body never knew what the hell was going on. So it made it okay to drink. It also made it very interesting for me to justify the morning drink. That, you know, yeah, it's 7:30 in the morning, but I worked all night. That's not really drinking in the morning, which is okay until you start making phone calls at 9 o'clock. You want to check on your pay. And I'm just trying to see what's going on. Sergeant Brian, have you been drinking? Why? you know, when it just started, I just started having problems. My last drunk, what I hope to be my last drunk, I started barbecuing that morning and I started drinking because that's what you do when you're going to barbecue at noon. You need to be ready for the meat to go on the grill. And I overshot perfect, and I went into, boy, I really need a nap. And we called them combat naps. That, you know, you got a little too drunk, if there's a definition of that. You're a little too drunk. I just need to lay down. Let me take about an hour nap, and then I can get up and I can drink some more. If you're going to go back out for some more field research, I recommend it. Gives you a little kick in the pants. Off you go again. And when I woke up, I found out that my friends at the party had gotten my dog drunk and then left. So I had this white German Shepherd Akita mix that was very, very sick. And as it turned out, she ended up with a sobriety date a little earlier than mine. And I got her sober, and I was pissed off, and we were going to go to the club that night and really drink. You know, this was just the barbecue. We were going to go out that night and really drink. And it was during my cowboy phase. I had my cowboy costume on. And I don't know if you were a chameleon, but, you know, I was just whatever I needed to be at the time. You know, wife number two liked country music. Okay, I'll like country music. You know, so I had my Tony Lama boots and my Wrangler jeans and my big belt buckle with my name on it so I knew who I was, and my plaid shirt, and off to the club we go, and I blacked out, and I came out of my blackout in a homicidal rage. And I can tell you today that if I'd have had a gun, I'd have shot him. If I'd have had a knife, I'd have gutted him. If I'd had a crowbar, I'd have beat his brains in. And it terrified me. It absolutely terrified me because I didn't know who he was. I didn't know why I was mad. I didn't really know where I was. The only thing that I knew with any clarity was my head hurt really bad. And the only reason that I can tell you about any of these events is because there's a police records and written statements. They help a lot because my memory of the night is kind of jaded. Anyway, I got pissed off and decided I was going to walk home. There was a lot of yelling, and people were upset, and they were worried about me driving. I didn't know that I could find my car, much less drive it. And I'm like, here's the keys. I don't care. I'm going to walk home. It was several miles, and I'll try to paint the picture for you. I had screwed my knee up earlier that summer, saving a beer from a volleyball. And I was wearing a metal brace, and I was a very sloppy, messy drunk. I'm the kind of guy that, you know, sometimes in the bathroom at the club, I miss. And my solution to that is buy black jeans. You know, it'll be okay. So, you know, this thing got wet on a pretty regular basis, and it was rusty and it squeaked. So I decided that I'm going to walk home, and, you know, here I am in my boots, and rink-a-rink-a-rink-a-rink-a, down the road I go. And I get a couple, and my head is killing me. And I get a couple of hundred yards down the road, and I went past the police station. And my keen alcoholic mind said to me, you should go into the police station and just ask those nice gentlemen for a ride. After all, you haven't done anything wrong. You're just drunk. That seemed like a really good idea, a whole lot better than walking a couple of miles. And I went in and sat down, and I was bleeding really bad. If I hadn't decided to walk in there tonight, you might have somebody different speaking tonight. I might have bled to death on the side of the road. I walked in and they said, dude, how'd you get in a fight? And I went, oh, is that why my head hurts? Wow. And suddenly everything came clear, and it felt like the pain was emanating from my chin. And I went, ooh, and I went to hold my hand up. And by the time I got it up underneath my chin, it was full of blood. And I looked down, and my shirt was covered in blood. My jeans had blood on them. My boots had blood on them. I'm like, dude, I've been in a fight. And, yeah, a little bit. And they took me to the hospital, and they sewed my face up. And I was laid open to the bone. I don't recommend, if you're going to get in a fight, doing it with somebody that has a black belt in karate. They will beat the crap out of you. And he was my friend. Anyway, they sewed me up, and they gave me a little alcohol test, and I failed it miserably. And the Air Force has an interesting program where they whisk you off into their evaluation, and they talk to everybody that you know and you work for and your wife and your kids, and they ask everybody what the deal is. And my theme song to my wife was, whatever you do, do not tell them that I'm an alcoholic. And somehow, and I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I really didn't. I didn't have a clue. Somehow I knew that that was a bad word. Don't use that word, and it'll be okay. And they gave me a test. How much do you drink a day? Blank. Just blank. Just put numbers in there. How the hell do you do that? If I tell them how much I drink a day, they will call me an alcoholic. If I tell them that I drink 2 beers a day, they will know that I'm lying. 3 to 18. How many days a week do you drink? Not, come on. What is, every day is bad. They won't buy 2 days. 3 to 6. There. You know, so I put dashes in this whole thing, which is apparently a good way to fail. So they diagnosed me with a little bit of a problem, and they said, okay, here's what you're going to do. And I know these things because I have a written order. They said, you will abstain from alcohol for 1 year. You will go to our 30-day inpatient treatment center. You will go to 3 AA meetings a week. You will get an AA sponsor, and then you will do our 1 year of aftercare once you get out of treatment. And the only thing that I heard was 1 year. You want me to not drink for 1 year? That's crazy. 1 year is like past New Year's. That's past 4th of July. That's past Friday. At the time, I wasn't drinking every day. My schedule didn't allow me to drink every day. But 3 days was as long as I could remember ever having been without drinking since I was 18 years old, and I had come out of basic training, 20 years old when I came out of basic training. A couple of days, and I was crazy. I was crazy. I needed to drink. And I went, how in the world am I going to do that? The Air Force isn't very fast, so this 30-day treatment center that they were going to put me in, I had to wait for a bed. So in the meantime, it was go find AA, go to the AA meetings. And I'm stationed in Misawa, Japan. It's on the northern tip of Honshu. If you go to nowhere and you turn left and you go about another 150 miles, that's where it was. Handful of English-speaking people that were calling themselves the Misawa Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked in there and sat down, and they were all old, and they all had terrible stories. They had all been to jail. I had only really visited jail. If you don't stay the night, it's really not being in jail. When I listened to their stories and I went, God, you guys are bad drinkers. If I had that kind of problem, I would stop too. But I'm just a nice guy that likes to drink a lot. Now, mind you, my face looks like somebody tap danced on it. I still have black thread hanging out of my chin where they've sewed me open. And I'm going, I really can't relate when you're talking about getting beat up. And they said, you should keep coming back. And I don't remember with any clarity what my first meeting was like. What I can tell you is that I remember at the end we stood up and held hands and they prayed the Lord's Prayer, and I knew that they cared. It was the only thing that I walked away from my first meeting, is they didn't want anything from me, that they just cared. And it was the first message that I got. I have no idea what anybody said, what the topic was, anything else. I started going back to meetings and asking a bunch of questions. How do you know whether or not you're an alcoholic? And they would give me answers. How much do you have to drink to be an alcoholic? This one sweet little nurse, we couldn't have been more different. In our demographics and our education, everything about us, we were opposite ends of the spectrum. And she said, Alan, it's not what we drink or how often we drink or when we drink that makes us alcoholics. It's what happens to us when we drink. And I knew exactly what she was talking about. And she wasn't talking about blacking out. She wasn't talking about going to jail. She was talking about that magic that would happen when I drank that would allow me to turn everything off. That was a different reaction than other people had, and I got it. And then I started noticing, because they had big words on the wall that had God on them, and I went, uh-oh, this is not a good sign. I know where this is going to lead. And I'm looking at the third step and going, this sounds an awful lot like a Southern Baptist preacher. I think not. It took a little while before I ever said that out loud to my sponsor. He looked at me and thought, the Southern Baptist church does not want you. Trust me. This does not need to be one of your fears. But, I'll tell you what had happened, from a childhood where I had a faith that was real. When I sat down in an AA meeting and they said, we want you to pray in the morning and ask God for help staying sober, I went, nobody cares. Nothing's listening. If there's a God, it doesn't matter. That's how far alcohol removed me from anything that I had that worked in my life. And I sat there. I went off to treatment. When I was in treatment, I started trying to work on something akin to an inventory. It wasn't. my sponsor, in his great wisdom, you know, I said, I'm getting ready to go to treatment. I hear from the other guys that they make you do this life inventory thing. I'm getting ready to do the fourth step. None of this, of course, you know, with his knowledge. I'm telling him like he should know. I'm getting ready to do the fourth step, and, you know, is there a way that I can combine these things and kind of do this together? So why don't you just go do treatment? Just go do treatment. Do what they tell you to do. When you come back, we'll worry about the steps. Really profound piece of advice. Anyway, I went off to treatment. When I was there, the last week was family week. I went to, my wife is in northern Japan. I'm in the Philippines. I did not get a tattoo. And I'm really concerned, and I think everything is falling apart in my life, which is a good indication because it was. And she showed up during family week and told me she wanted a divorce. And maybe you misunderstood family week. This is how we get to put things back together again. And she looked at me and she said, I would have left years ago, but I knew that you would lock yourself in a room and you'd have drank yourself to death. You're locked up here. You're sleeping in the psych ward. You're safe. You know, the little miracles that started happening to me one after another that I can't ascribe to coincidence. She wasn't that bright. One of my friends said, face it, you know, you did not marry her because she was a brain surgeon. But she knew enough to know what alcoholism looked like and what was going to happen to me. You know, I got out of treatment. I went back. We packed her up and sent her back to California. And I got on about the business of going back and forth to AA meetings. Pretty miserable. Absolutely pretty miserable. My life dissolved down to a 10-by-10 room. They moved me back into the barracks. My career was in a shambles. It's too long a story to tell, but suffice it to say that my timing when I was in jail was about as bad as it could be. Yeah, I will tell it. There's only two people in a weather station in a military facility that can go and brief the commander on decisions that affect the entire installation. We had a typhoon moving up the coast, and they were getting ready to take all the F-16s and move them. There's only two guys that can brief, the commander and the first sergeant. There's only two guys that they require to show up and get you out of jail, the commander and the first sergeant. They were late for the briefing. My career was, there was a flashing red dissipation light. It was going away. And I'm down to this 10-by-10 room. Everything that I own, she took everything. I got another bad tattoo. I'm looking around going, I don't want to live like this anymore. And AA isn't helping. Going back and forth and going to meetings and talking about it isn't helping. This is my story. Lots of well-meaning people patted me on the back and said, keep coming back. And they almost killed me. Because I needed a solution. I needed something in my life that was going to save me from alcoholism. And what happened is I looked up one day and I went, I don't want to live like this anymore. And I got ready to hang myself in the bathroom. And I looked down at my watch and it was 7:05. And I'm not sure why I looked at my watch. I believe God works in really mysterious ways today. The AA meetings in Misawa, Japan on that night, they didn't meet every night, on that night were at 7:00. And I said, okay, I'll try one more time. And I walked back into that AA meeting that night late. And I walked in and I said, make it stop hurting. I can't live like this. Make it stop hurting. I'll do anything you tell me to do, but I can't live like this. And they said, Alan, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. If you will do this deal, you will never have to feel this way again. And I got busy. I got busy. You know how long it takes to do an inventory? 5 months of complaining and 2 nights. You know, when your choices are suicide or taking a look at yourself, you know, an inventory starts looking a whole lot better. I had a lot of problems with God. I had a lot of problems with this third step. I didn't have any problems when I got desperate. You know, and the book talks about that a lot. You know, one of my heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous says, you know, I wish you desperation. And I get that today. And I'm grateful that I got desperate. And I'm grateful that there were people there that didn't say keep coming back, that they said, here's the steps, get started, do something. And I made him a deal, and I don't recommend this, but I said, I'll do whatever you tell me for 6 months. If it isn't any better, then I'm going to kill myself. And my story is very simple. It doesn't take 6 months to work the steps. It doesn't take 6 months to write an inventory, do a fifth step, do the six and seven step. It doesn't take that long to begin making amends. And I looked up one day, and I couldn't remember when I wanted to drink. And I looked around and went, what happened? What happened? Only through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous does that happen in my life. Because I'm the kind of guy that goes back and forth and sits in meetings and gets suicidal. That's my story. You know, when I got busy and I started doing something, things changed. And it changed pretty dramatically. That summer, three of us from that little group climbed Mount Fuji in, outside of Tokyo, and climbed it all night long and stood on the top and watched the sunrise over the Pacific Ocean. I stood there, free man. And looked out over that and smoked a Marlboro cigarette because I was really spiritual. And, you know, and went, you know, you can't get there from here. You know, that, you know, it really is a miracle. As I've heard many times, and it's just been wonderful ever since. Not my story, though. Some of my worst behavior came after I got sober, because I got wonderful, right? I got spiritual, and now I'm going to fix everybody. I got a little confused. When it talked about practicing these principles in all our affairs, I thought that meant something about married women, and I had a little problem. It was interesting because my sponsor, I skipped going to the Saturday morning meeting, and I talked to my sponsor later that afternoon, and he goes, oh, you missed it. It was great. And I went, really? How many was there? And it's like, oh, it was just me and Terry, but we had a new guy come in. And he's like, boy, Rod looks really miserable. You know, he's having problems with his wife. I said, whoa, what was his name? Rod. Uh-oh. And what else did he say? And then began the real trick of getting sober in a group with about 12 people. When you're sitting across the room from the guy that you're sleeping with his wife, and the topic that day is honesty. And Rod got drunk. And I wanted to know how to fix it. And my sponsor gave me some instructions that are in the book. He said, why don't you stop sleeping with her? There's a good start. Okay, how do I make amends? And he goes, you don't get to. You get to not sleep with her anymore. That's how you get to fix this. And I started learning that, you know, I don't get to fix things with I'm sorry anymore, that I have to start acting differently. Rod came back, and Rod got sober. And one of the people in that group, when we were getting ready to leave, said, you know, what I got to watch was the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous work, with you guys sitting in a meeting and getting up afterwards and hugging each other. And when I didn't believe that it would ever work for me, I looked at you guys and I went, if it can work for them, it can work for anybody. You know, and I began to just have miracles happen in my life one after another. I met and married my wife in Alcoholics Anonymous. I listened to my sponsor for many years talk about, I am married to my best friend. And I went, ew. Does sex with your best friend? Ew. I could tell you that I am married to my best friend today, and it's remarkable. There's nobody in the world that I would rather spend time with. And I learned to love her in Alcoholics Anonymous for who she was, not who I wanted her to be. Chris is not my type. My type's tall, trashy women that sleep with my best friends and then take my TV. As a side note to the story, I've never gotten a tattoo either, which seems to be a key to the puzzle. I got involved in service work. I got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life just got rich and rewarding. When I first got sober, I heard them say, if you will make a list of everything that you've ever wanted, and you will put it in an envelope and seal it up, and you open it up down the road, you would find out that you sold yourself short for what Alcoholics Anonymous would give you. And I looked at him and went, you chumps don't know how to write, do you? Can you even spell Lamborghini? Because I can make a list. You know, I can make a list. It'll have a lot of money, it'll have a lot of things, it'll have a lot of stuff, and it'll all be wonderful. You know, and I never wrote on the list that I wanted to be able to lay my head on the pillow at night and go to sleep free. That there's no one on the face of the planet that I'm scared to see today. There are still people that I owe amends to that I have not been able to find. If they walked in here tonight, I'd pay them what I owe them. I'd have never wrote it on the list. I'd have never wrote on the list that I want to sit and work with someone and help them do the steps and watch the miracle happen in front of my eyes. To watch them go from being absolutely terrified to being at peace with who and what they are. I'd have never put that on the list. I'd have never wrote on the list that I wanted to hold my mom's hands and paint her fingernails while she died of Alzheimer's. My dad, Chris and I were getting ready to go to a convention, an AA convention in August, one that you have a flyer for, that my sponsor is there and all my brother pigeons, and it's a great time of year, and we were excited about going. And right as we were packing, we were getting ready to go out the door, I got a phone call from my sister, and they said, Dad took a turn for the worse. Dad's in the hospital. And he's fallen again, and this time they did a brain scan, and they found a brain tumor that's about a quarter the size of his skull. And they don't know if he's going to make it through surgery, but they're doing surgery. And Chris and I got in the car, and we drove all night, and we got to Alabama. And the surgeon came out, and he talked to us, and he said, we've taken it out, but he will have maybe a year if he comes out. We don't know whether he'll come out or not, and we don't know what kind of memory he'll have. I was standing at the end of the bed when he woke up, and he looked up and he said, what a good sight to wake up to. My dad was a deacon in the Baptist church, and he was embarrassed by me for a good chunk of his life. And he was just quiet and kept his mouth shut and continued to love me and continued to wait. You know, when I got to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous in front of him and to do something different, and to see something different happen. You know, you taught me how, you know, words are cheap, actions are what matter. Do something different. I was on the phone with my mom, and when they were both alive and they were living in Alabama, Chris and I were in Ohio, and I was talking to my mom about my first divorce and how it was the best money that I had ever spent. And she said, best money I ever spent. And I went, yeah, what do you mean? And she was like, I paid for that. And I went, well, I don't remember it that way. And she's like, yeah, you don't remember a lot of things right. And I said, well, I need to pay you back. Well, I don't want your money. I said, okay, well, you've been talking about painting the house, haven't you? Oh, yeah, we definitely need to paint the house. And I loaded up my drop cloths and my rollers and my ladders, and I drove to Alabama, and I painted their house. And one of my greatest memories is my dad and I sitting in the hallway cutting in trim on the floor. And that wasn't long before he died. And, you know, if it hadn't been for you and telling me how to do something different, you know, they don't want their money back. You know, they want their son back. You know, why don't you show up and act like a son? You know, when I first read Rocketed into a Fourth Dimension, I went, what hokey crap. I'll tell you, if I don't ever get anything out of Alcoholics Anonymous besides the opportunity to be the son that I was to my dad and my mom before they died, I'm overpaid. I have time to tell you a quick story. When we were in Ohio, and I was, I had finally got my dream job in the Air Force. I was running a weather station. One guy told me early in my career, he said, if you just keep your mouth shut and go on along about your business, one day they'll put you in charge and you can fix it. And I went, ooh, I get a chance to fix it. It's going to be good. And right after I got there, we had a need to send somebody to Saudi Arabia, and I was the one that I needed to send. So I had to, Bosnia. So My 16-year-old son from my first marriage was moving in with Chris and I. And 7 days after he got there, I got on a plane and I went to Bosnia. And at the time, if you opened up the international directory of AA meetings, you would not find one at Camp Eagle, Tuzla Air Base, Bosnia-Herzegovina. And I was coming up on 10 years. 10 years. 10 years is the big coin, right? It's got the X on it. You know, they come and touch the hem of your garment in AA when you get 10 years. This is how God, as I understand him, works in my life, right? You seem to have a little bit of an ego problem, Alan. We will send you 10,000 miles away from any kind of chip and any kind of birthday party and any kind of celebration that might bolster that. Why don't you go and get in touch with the miracle that's here and not the number that's on your chip? And I packed up all my speaker tapes and my literature and off I went. And I spent the first couple of days walking around in minefields and in and out of helicopters and going to the top of Russian hospitals and doing crap that weather guys are not supposed to do, and carrying a live weapon. Like, this is all not a good idea, and I need a meeting. I'd really rather be in a meeting. But I know that there's not any meetings here, and I know what the math is, right? There's about 2,000 people on this base. Most of them are under 30 years old. So there's not much of a demographic for AA anyway. But if you do the math, they say that about 10% of the people that ever drink will be affected by alcoholism. About 10% of those people will end up going to AA meetings. About 10% of those people will end up staying sober. So if you run that down, there should have been less than two people possible to be there. And I know what the odds are. There's not anything there. But I've been taught to take the action, move your feet. Feet prayers are what counts. So I pick up the phone and I make some phone calls, and the guy says, I'll check and I'll see what I can find out for you. And he calls me back and he says, there's a guy at the field psychiatric unit that said that he will see you. I went, I don't want to go to the field psychiatric unit. I want to go to a meeting. I certainly don't want to go to the place that says, check your weapon at the door. Okay, whatever. And I called the guy and I made an appointment. I didn't want to go see him. And I walked back and forth past his tent every day on the way to work. And I went a couple of days and I went, I'm just going to stop in here and tell him that, you know, we really don't need to do this. I just wanted to see if there was an AA meeting. And I walked in the front door and Kevin looked up from the desk and he went, hey, I know you. And it took us a minute. Kevin and I had sat in intergroup meetings in Seoul, Korea, 10,000 miles on the other side of the world, about 7 years before that, and hadn't been in touch since. And, you know, the book says whenever two or more are together, and Kevin and I started having a meeting every day. We met at lunch, and we sat, and we talked program, and we talked about our lives, and we talked about all our friends that we were connected to. And our popular argument was, who saved who? You know, did God send you here to save me, or vice versa? And we rolled along and it was just wonderful. And, as we started coming up on my birthday, I said, you know, Chris is going to call. We're going to do kind of a little, teleconference. You know, it would be nice if you would be there, but, you know, I hadn't been in Ohio really long enough to have a home group. I certainly don't have anybody going to send me a chip. You know, it'll just be this phone thing. And Kevin looked at me and he said, you know, I celebrated 11 years. Just a couple of months ago, and my group sent me my chip. I have a 10-year chip that I can give you. Go ahead and do that math. Make that work in your head. None of that would have happened if I hadn't taken the action, if I hadn't said, I need to go to a meeting. Can you help me? You know, I had to open my mouth and ask. Now, the rest of that story is, fast forward about 11 years. Chris and I are living in Germany, and I'm working in Germany. But I'm going to school in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and my sponsor is in Bellevue, Nebraska. But the weekend that I was going to be there, that I would be able to visit in between my school, he took a meeting into the state penitentiary. And we knew that this was going to happen ahead of time. And he was like, well, why don't you just put your paperwork in and you can go to the meeting with me? And I went, oh, that'd be great. And I had done some institutions work, and I said, this will be cool. So I put the paperwork in, and they came back, and they said, the group would like you to speak. And I went, I didn't think it was a speaker meeting. And I called my sponsor and I went, they want me to speak. And he says, say yes. Oh, okay. So I put on my shirt and tie and I show up and I tell a story and I tell about Kevin. And a guy comes up to me after the meeting. He goes, God, it was a really powerful story. Do you and Kevin still keep in touch? And I looked at him and I went, that's really not part of the story. Thanks. Chump. I didn't say it in so many words. I went, no, it's been a while since Kevin and I have been in touch. That's a really good point. And he's like, wow, yeah, you guys should stay in touch. And he walked away and I went, you know, I never know where God's message is going to come from. You know, sometimes it comes from inside, you know, a federal penitentiary. And I spent the rest of the weekend with my sponsor and I got back and I sat down on my computer and I pulled up Kevin's name on Facebook. And Bink, he came right up. And we chatted for a minute and I went, God, it's been a while. And I told him about the story. And Kevin's story is very similar. He has a really powerful story about what came from us meeting. And we started talking and I said, so how you doing? He's like, great. I retired from the Army. You know, I'm a drug and alcohol counselor now. And I went, well, that's super. Where you work? And he's like, well, I work at Fort Leavenworth. Where in Fort Leavenworth do you work? And he's like, well, I'm in Building 100. He was about 100 yards from where I was sitting. You know, and what I've seen happen in AA over and over again is, you know, God shows up. God shows up. Sometimes God shows off. You know, and I keep coming back just waiting for the next time that he has an opportunity to show off. Sometimes it's when somebody shows up at a meeting and they manage to find some hope and they say, I believe that you have something that might work in my life. If you're here and you're new tonight, if you're here and you've been here a while, if you're here and it hurts, grab somebody after the meeting and say, please help me. And let the miracle begin there. That's how it happened for me, and I'm so grateful that you let me share it with you tonight. Thanks for letting me share.